If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with a New York State Certified seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to episode 5 of Why Food. I'm back at base camp, back in Roberta's. I did my little stint back in Ireland for 2 episodes. And this week I'm back and I'm really bringing it back to Brooklyn with Vincent Mazzeau from Cherry Point in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Welcome, Vincent.
Yeah, Patrick, thanks.
So I was just asking Vincent before, because with the Cherry Point group, we have you as the owner, but then there's 3 of you involved. There's yourself, Julian Calcott, and Gareth Smith.
Yep. Julian Calcott, chef. Gareth Smith, GM, beverage director.
Cool. Yeah. And as we have with the show with Why Food, there's always the transition of the movement from one world into another. And with Julian and with Gareth, you have 2 guys who've been centered in the hospitality industry for pretty much their whole careers, right?
Yeah, I think they would each say they have like 15 years in the business.
Great. And then we have you coming in as the visionary, switching from one path to another. So how's everything going? How's it been going to open up your first restaurant?
Really well. Really exciting. You know, full court press constantly, but so it's a lot of hard work, but a lot to enjoy about it too.
When did the process start that you came up with the idea that you wanted to open up Cherry Point?
Cherry Point specifically, you know, knowing I was going to open a restaurant, I was pursuing it on a daily basis. We were just talking about it the other day. It's probably a year and 10 months of constant work to make it happen. But, you know, to get to this point, but probably about 4 years ago, knowing I was stopping the artwork, stopping the commercial work to educate myself and angle towards opening a restaurant in general.
Okay, so let's get right into it. Let's get back to that other world of yours. So you worked in art, you worked in set design. How long were you in that industry for?
That's one of those things where I just say art my whole life. You know, always a maker, always fiddling with stuff, figuring out how things work. Went to art school as an undergraduate, came to Brooklyn, had a studio practice, then went back to grad school for art, and then following grad school started a business to make money as an art director hand in hand with having a studio practice.
I just want to bring you back to that, to when you went to school, because to bring it back to a much more personal level, my sister just started in art college. So I went to study law in college, where it was far more strict and regimented. You know, there was no sense of expression as to you finding yourself. Whereas when I went to see her going to school, it was just airy-fairy. You know, I saw a guy drinking a can of Coke. He finished it, went up to the table, took out a knife, turned it into some completely different object, and then went back and went to his daily business. You know, that's just the kind of school that she was in. But you studied sculpture in Yale. So going to somewhere like Yale, that is steeped in history, steeped in its academic prestige. What was it like going to study sculpture there? Was it somewhere where you could find yourself and express yourself, or was it very much a centered school of thought?
That's a great question. The really great thing about pursuing sculpture at Yale as a grad student was we were kind of the irascible child of the program. We had our own building separate from the main art school that was built, you know, in the 70s, and sculpture was really a term for anything but painting and photography, but we could still paint and do photography if we wanted to. We had just 9 of us in each year, 18 of us in the program, and I mean, we could work with metal, we could be dancers, we could be, you know, performance artists, anything we wanted. So, but you had to back it up. You had to have the words to back it up. You had to have the thought process behind it, the rigor.
And leaving there, what was your goal and ambition?
It was pretty much to be a New York studio artist, have a studio, have shows and galleries and all that. And but pretty soon after meeting a couple of friends there, you know, we felt like the bohemian model was bankrupt, literally, and figuratively speaking, it wasn't a model to follow. So we joined forces, got studios together with enough space to also run a business of doing art direction, which we kind of fell into.
And was that the birth of your first company, Big Room?
Right, exactly. Yep. Pretty much within a year out of school, or a couple of months out of school, started working with Richard Avedon on a project and just fell into that by happenstance through connections, through friends, and really discovered that as a business, working with photographers, designing sets, art directing shoots.
So this is a world that's completely separate to mine, something that I really don't know much about. So when you find a when you founded a company like that, what was the goal? Where did you, what kind of commercial side of business did you want to get into? Was it very much that you wanted to hold onto your artistic values, or did you want to associate yourself with the brands that you'd be known to work with, like the fashion companies like Dolce & Gabbana and Calvin Klein?
Well, very specifically both, because we wanted to keep our individual names, our individual persons, you know, in our studios, Vincent Mezzo, the artist, making my sculpture, my art, and separately formed the company, an LLC, just to be Big Room and say Big Room and have a commercial identity that was separate from our artistic identities. So so we could totally embrace the fashion world and commercial world and those brands and be part of it, but keep it as separate as we could. I mean, really, we solely pursued the commercial aspect of it to support our art habit, you know?
Right, which seems to be the common theme.
Yeah.
You have to go into that corporate world to get the money to fund the creative sides of yourself.
Totally. I think the really exciting thing for us, though, the reason we called it Big Room, was we did have that spirit of including our other friends as well. They're so talented on so many levels, maybe had less business acumen than we did collectively, the three of us. So we were able to employ most of our friends making props and working on sets and prop shopping, running around the city, you know.
And how long, what was the lifespan of Big Room? How long did the company last for?
About 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in that, you were, once it got to a stage, were you solely working on set design? Or were you still working side by side as an artist and set design?
It actually reached this, you know, pretty desirable goal of being just the right amount of on and off. You know, I would be able to, you know, we had representation agents that help us connect us with work, and I was able to say to my agent, I have a show coming up, I want the next 2 months to see it through. I'm going to say no to a lot of jobs unless it's somebody that I work with frequently and they really need me on something, and I could plug in and unplug myself, and you know, also some jobs weren't that difficult and I could work at night in the studio. You know, there wasn't necessarily weekends and work weeks and things like that. In that way, it has a strong parallel to the restaurant industry, which is nonstop. So I've only ever worked that way anyway.
And what stage or what triggered you to make the move into the food industry? At what stage did you say, I want to part ways with this and I want something different?
You know, there's it took some looking back, you know, like now, of course, everything is retrospect and I could draw a straight line through my whole life towards this. But there were moments, I remember we were interviewed for like ID Magazine, 30 Under 30, and they ask you those questions like, well, if you weren't doing this, you know, what would you be doing? And I was like, I'd be a chef, you know, like presumptuously said that. But, you know, it was like, yeah, that seemed like a distant fantasy thing. If we had two lives to live, maybe I'd go for it.
And even back in your early days when you were studying sculpture, yeah, was food still a love interest? Was it something that you were strongly connected to?
Well, it's like interesting for me how it went. My education as an artist and you know, reading art history went hand in hand with this, because the artists I was excited about in the 50s, they all congregated at like one bar, you know, Cedar Tavern in the Village, and those romantic notions took hold just as quickly as like how interested I was in their work. So yeah, I think, you know, at school, before school, living in crazy studios in Brooklyn, you know, I was the one that welded together a 55-gallon drum into the barbecue, would buy meat, start cooking, and then the party would happen. You know, I was always trying to build conversation and social scene just around cooking, and art happened too, or while doing art, food happened too, you know.
Because what I find most interesting about this, because with all the guests that I have had and will have going into the near future, a lot of them went into food because they felt stifled with the job that they were in. You know, I had Martha Hoover, for example. She was a lawyer. She couldn't feel like she expressed herself. We had Casey. He was working in the opera. He couldn't feel like he could express his creative talents when he was with the projects that he was working on. But your job was centered in creativity. But there was something still that you were yearning for in terms of food. Was it the creativity that you wanted, or you just wanted the close connection and relationship to food on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you just wrote it directly in creativity, because it was kind of a deal I made with myself when I switched from an undergraduate. I went in to be like a photojournalist. Then I got excited about painting and sculpture and everything else, and I figured, you know, I can do this, because no matter what, I'll always have art, whether or not it leads directly to a career or a job. So I'll always be creative. I'll be completely empowered by this. Like, you know, that was the confidence I had in learning those things. And, you know, yeah, that's what remained. But then that pursuit is, it's only ever challenged by doing the next thing you know nothing about, you know, whether it's a material, whether it's a narrow focus in the realm of, like, making sculpture, making art. So I think I just kept following that through to the next end, you know, moved into the commercial aspect of it. And, you know, there's 25 pages in Vogue magazine. What do you do with it, given a photographer, the fashion, the models? That was, like, really compelling, surprisingly compelling. But, you know, after 15 years of pursuing the sort of gallery-based, arguably commercial art world, I was on the verge of having my second one-person show with a gallery, and my son was born, and it was just kind of like my son was more important, being around him was more important, and figuring out the next thing was more important than what was becoming workaday,
right,
for the art world and pleasing gallerists and people at art fairs and worrying about selling work or making multiples of sculptures so you can make money.
Is the art world far more individualistic than working in the restaurant business? Do you have to focus on, because you have to focus on your own soul achievements and you kind of have to create it for yourself and your own vision, as opposed to working in a restaurant day in, day out with a team where you're all funneling together to create the goal of whether it be great hospitality or great food or merging all that enlightened hospitality together?
I mean, yeah, certainly the art world. I mean, if you're that kind of artist, you know, alone in your studio making singular objects, paintings, photography, photographs, sculptures, there's still a team involved in those to some degree, but obviously you're leading the show completely.
Right.
You know, but the art direction, I think, is what taught me more about collaborative efforts that were really compelling. Having a photographer, director of photography on a film, you know, and then myself, production designer, art director, those three creative forces with, you know, very particular skill sets coming together to create a singular campaign or image or commercial, that's most similar to.
So there's definitely aspects of it that tie in with working in the food industry, but they obviously still have their separations.
Yeah, I mean, the one huge distinction is the constant process of becoming, you know, the restaurant, becoming a certain style of hospitality, becoming a certain style of food, and a particular place, you know, that has a real place in the real world, you know. That's the distinct difference by far.
When you started, when you said, okay, I'm going to open up my own restaurant, what did you have in mind? Because I have dreams and visions of restaurants I'd want to have, but I know when it comes down to it, and if someone was to really say, hey, get some money together, get a team together, it'd kind of condense and come down to something far more simple. So when you started off, did you have very wonderful, grandiose dreams of the restaurant that you wanted to have? Or did you have very humble beginnings and saying, I just want to make something where I can bring people to eat and enjoy a social setting?
That's really funny. Probably have a lot of answers for that. But, you know, it was really just a creative process. You know, sometimes you have like a well-formed image or nearly completely formed image, and then you try and get that out of yourself and into the world by sheer force, you know, somehow. Or, but I think I just went on a long process of discovery. You know, another way to do it is just look at models of things you like, things you love. How can you be something like them but still do something unique, something your own?
Did you go on many trips abroad?
So, you know, the most wonderful aspect of this whole thing is the research, and it involves eating and drinking, and just I've done that as much as I can for as long as I can at this point. So, yeah, some really great trips were to like Buenos Aires and to Paris to see what was going on there. Yeah, and just anywhere I go, I really do, I'm on the hunt for the high and low experiences I can access, you know, in terms of food and drink.
Yeah, that's definitely the peak of the job. I just read Joe Bastianich's Restaurant Man not so long ago, and hearing about his regular trips every time they'd open up a restaurant, going around the Italian coast or focusing on some Italian region, just sounds like a dream.
Well, and then just running around Brooklyn and New York, it's just insane. There's so many places, you know. Really a pleasure, yeah.
So it starts off in this dream, you're almost on cloud nine, and then you come crashing back down to earth, and then you have all the operations that you have to deal with and the nuts and bolts to bring a place together.
Nothing's crashing. No,
no?
It's all good. It's cool. Like, you know, keeps me off the streets.
Good stuff. All right, well, we're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts, as we just said, of Cherry Point, see where it is, what the dream is, and the team that's brought it all together.
And music in this break is by EULA. This song is called Awake. We'll be right back.
Chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
Welcome back to Why Food. I'm here with Vincent Mazzo from Cherry Point. So Vincent, let's get into it, man. When you started off, or let's get into the team. So Julian Colcott, Garrett, and yourself, how do you split yourselves?
Well, Julian's the chef. That's an easy one. It's pretty much everything from the kitchen door back and beyond is his. You know, Garrett and I and Julian have a great collaborative spirit between us, so we have a lot to say about the food. But you know, Julian's receptive, but there he is, Julian's chef. Garrett, he's probably worked in every aspect of the front of house in his 15 years, starting bar back, bartender, bar manager, the whole bit. So, including opening GM for the Finch last year, helping get it a Michelin star. So Garrett, GM, we kind of share that role. But Garrett's got the history with hospitality, so he trains the staff, and also great depth of knowledge of wines and the bar program, cocktails and stuff.
Cool.
And then I do everything else.
I'm sure.
Everything
yeah.
around that and collaborate with those guys.
When things break down, I'm sure the man to call.
Yeah, I'm always there. We're always there. So we're always on hand.
And how is it? Is it unique with the structure of that for a restaurant where now in modern day times in New York, because it's so expensive to open a restaurant, that what you would have is a group of partners or a group of investors, and then funneling down from them, then you would have, say, one figurehead, and then below that you would have another. Whereas, I suppose, you have you as the owner, but then you have the trio of partners, so the three of you are operating together. Is it a better structure? Do you think you benefit more than that, than the now modern-day typical structure of a New York restaurant, where you have a host of investors focusing in on one person who's leading the line?
I mean, ask me that question in a year from now, but I'll have a better answer. But cool. Right now, man, it's been real smooth sailing because we're lean and mean, and the whole design process, the whole build-out process, you know, the money is in my control, but having done all this commercial work, I know how to control the budget, keep an eye on a budget. Garrett and Julian as well have run their respective, you know, budgets and restaurants they've worked in. So, yeah, we just all kept our eye on the prize, and it's just we have each other to answer to and no one else. So we can make decisions quicker, act on them, know what's working, what's not working.
Benefit.
And we don't have to get five owners in a room to taste a sauce and say, okay, it goes on the menu. You know?
Right. That bureaucratic nature really slows things
down.
Yeah,
yeah. So we were able to open in like 6 months from lease signing to opening the doors, and that's pretty much the goal, and not everybody can make that happen, and you know, we did it, you know.
Cool. So can you just talk the listeners through what Cherry Point is, what the vision of it is, and the layout, and what you hope to offer the customers, or the guests, I should say, as they come in?
You know, I think it did first come out of a sense of place, you know. It sounds obvious for me to say that as a set designer, but you know, we all have history in Brooklyn. I landed in Greenpoint in around 1988, 89. You know, been in Brooklyn all these years, coming and going a little bit, but so strong allegiance to Brooklyn, the Greenpoint neighborhood, Garrett as well. And even though we didn't know we were going to be able to end up there, it makes too much sense. It's perfect. We wanted to be there, be part of that neighborhood. And knowing it's still a growing neighborhood, even though it's like right next to Williamsburg, it's still not really part of that. It kind of defies its own celebrity status in a way, you know.
Right. That's one thing I wanted to touch on, because you describe yourselves as a neighborhood restaurant. But was it far easier to make yourselves a neighborhood restaurant in a place like Greenpoint, where it is still rooted in its history, compared to Williamsburg, where it's a whole other place in the past 8 years compared to what it was in the past?
Yeah, I mean, you know, no, can't really see it for anything else. I mean, Greenpoint's gentrifying as well, all along the waterfront, the building that's going on. It's pretty intense. But where we are, there's this amazing nexus, right? Right where Greenpoint meets Williamsburg at the McCarran Park. And we're just around the corner on that main drag, which is Manhattan Avenue. And it's just storefront after storefront after storefront. And it pretty much looks the same as it did 25 years ago, except for now these little moments here and there, just a 15-foot storefront becoming an AT&T store, or, you know, the storefront next door to it is a great coffee shop, you know, and an old-school one, and, you know, a brand new one, but right. People that are roasting their own beans and stuff, you know. So it's a crazy, wonderful, like quintessential New York mix of businesses there.
And the space is an old butcher shop. So did that make an impact on the restaurant that you wanted to have?
You know, I would have said from, you know, this time last year, we already had that sort of ethos as part of our goal, our business plan. Julian's been doing butchering, whole animal butchering in restaurants for years, for I think 12 years. And, you know, Garrett and I and Julian all love eating that way ourselves, like charcuterie, and also aiming to be sort of ethically motivated in the way that we source products and utilize them. So finding a former butcher shop was kind of like amazing, you know, just serendipity. So, yeah, we're able to amp that up even a little bit more by borrowing some of the aesthetics from the existing materials there and running with that just a little bit more than we might have otherwise.
And there's one thing about the aesthetic of the restaurant, because you walk in there and is it 6 months old now? 5 months old?
Just 4 months.
4 months old?
Yeah.
But you go in there and you feel like the restaurant has been there for years. It almost feels like it's just gotten a few touch-ups over the years to make it, you know, make it more functional, but it still feels like it's got history, it's got something going on there, which is what a lot of restaurants try to do with the new Brooklyn aesthetic and ethos. You know, they're all stemming off something, which I think you've achieved. But going into that, and you wanted to make it a neighborhood restaurant, was that difficult to set yourself? I'm sure you were able to look at ways that it has worked. Five Leaves down the street, you know, they've definitely done it well, but there's a lot of other restaurants that really haven't hit the nail on the head. They've just tried to be Brooklyn, but they're not.
Yeah, again, maybe that comes down to, you know, really who's behind the project, right? Because nowadays, if you want to be really cynical, you know, we could look at there's a vegan place that just opened, super fast foody, but vegan restaurant near us. And it really looks like some, you know, architect, not architect, but contractor was paid to, like, here, make a Brooklyn restaurant. So you've got black pipe, exposed bulbs, Edison bulbs, reclaimed lumber. You know,
those kind of silver tin signs,
exposed brick, the tin ceiling. You can really speak cynically about those materials and say, of course, that's Brooklyn, you know, but it sounds like BS, you know.
Right.
But then we have tin, we have, like, salvaged floors, you know, reclaimed, you know, antique chestnut. But, I mean, you can do it with love and sincerity and really be part of Brooklyn and do those things. But you can, you know, just like any business, there are the innovators, you know, and there are just people that are copying what they see around them without the understanding of what it really is, you know.
I mentioned this food conference before this has bitten, and I wish I could have more factual information about what I'm about to say, but I can just remember a statement from one of the speakers talking about the comparison of when restaurants, if you were to look at them 10 years ago, they would look at Paris and they would look at everything that was happening in Paris. And let's stem from that. You know, even restaurants in Rio de Janeiro and Brazil, everywhere, Paris was the goal. Paris is where you went to because you only really had two forms of restaurants. You had the smaller scale, very, very casual, where the food was just average fare, or else you had a fine dining and you got your inspiration from Paris. Nowadays, it's far more popular to open up something that's casual, but with a great, great food, with a great menu, with great drinks. And the inspiration for that is Brooklyn. Brooklyn has now become the global inspiration for casual fine dining because, I don't know, the restaurants really seem to have hit the nail on the head. You can almost see the cross between the border of Manhattan and Brooklyn, the way that they've done it. Mm. Even casual tasting menus, it's almost crossed from Brooklyn into Manhattan. But on that, then there's people who have taken that and done it terribly, because I've seen an article in Adelaide where they've taken a space, tried to recreate a Brooklyn village. They've put a Jewish sandwich shop, an Italian barber. They actually put some sort of a radio station in amongst all of this. I think they were trying to recreate us right here at Heritage Radio Network. And they've just done it poorly. So I have to applaud you on what you've done, because when I walked in there that day, you could have told me that this place has been here for 40 years and you came in and spent a few grand on it to touch it up, and that's what it's been. Because it looks classy, but it has that casual simplicity of it that you can come in, bring someone in, chill out and sit down. And I'm sure that's what you wanted.
Cool. Yeah, thanks so much for saying that. Yeah, it's really gratifying. Yeah, we want just anybody and everyone be able to walk in there. I mean, I think at the end of the week, I'm most prideful if our little old Polish lady has come again for her hamburger with her rolling luggage. I don't know what's in there, but
the granny car.
She's there like once a week, then a girls' night out, and, you know, just every Polish and creative person and travelers all combining in there. It's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Amazing. One thing I want to ask you before we leave is, and I tried to touch on this with each guest, is what has food given you that you didn't have before you got into the industry?
Wow, that's a really great question. I mean, food, it's given me a business and a way to bring together kind of a second family, you know. I mean, it's often said that in the restaurant industry, these places become your surrogate family, your new family. You know, it really feels that way. We've already gone through some staff coming and going really quickly because I think we're getting to that place where it's the people that are really invested in and interested in what we're doing, and they can be themselves here. You know, it works for me that way as well. I love going there. Can't wait to go home. Can't wait to go to the restaurant, you know. It's really a lot of fun.
Great stuff. Thanks for coming on the show, Vincent.
Thanks a lot, man.
And for anyone that wants to go and taste some of the fare at Cherry Point, it's located on Manhattan Avenue, Greenpoint, right?
Yeah, 664 Manhattan Avenue between Bedford Avenue and Norman.
Cool.
Right by the G.
So Thanks very much for listening again, guys. If you want to catch this show or future shows, if you can't listen to it live, you can do so on iTunes and Stitcher. Just search for Why Food. If you like the show, please rate it. If you really like the show and you want to subscribe, that'd be amazing. I want to focus again on the ethos of this show, that it's one industry fits all. And that's really what we're trying to share here, that people can come from any background in life, take themselves into food. And once you channel that passion, it's amazing what you can create. Next week, we're going to have Adam Eskin, who's a gentleman that used to work in finance, and he turned his life around and opened up the Dig In franchise, which is in New York. And they recently moved to Boston. So thank you again to the Heritage Radio Network that have given us the opportunity to host this show. Thanks to Dave, our sound engineer. And really, really looking forward to having Adam on next week. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Thank you.